Jamie?
Yes, Marion.
I'm a bit sad to tell you that this is the end of the Lovecraft Show, as in there won't be any more seasons and there won't be any more episodes.
That's bad news, particularly as I'm still in the Lovecraft Show. What am I going to do now?
Well, don't worry, because we've got a new show for all our crafty loving listeners. It's going to be called Craft Talking. Guess who's going to be doing it?
Who's going to be doing it?
You!
Hey! Oh, I can live on to be another day. I tell you what, it's very weird just being a disembodied voice that exists in a podcast. There are so many trapped in other podcasts that have pod faded over time. But I can live on in another area. I'm so excited now. Craft Talking, you say?
Craft Talking. So it's going to be a fantastic new podcast with me and you. And we're going to talk to everybody and anybody. So people, listeners, don't forget to subscribe and find Craft Talking wherever you get your podcasts.
That's Craft Talking without a G, because we're so cool. See you there.
Bye. Jamie. What are you singing? Why are you singing that theme?
Because today on the Lovecraft Show, my beloved friends, we are going on something of a Star Trek.
Are you telling me we're going out of this world?
I think we're going supersonic, interstellar. Tell people who we've got on the show today, Marion.
We have been talking to astronaut Dr. Karen Nyberg.
The 50th woman to go into outer space in 2013. Dr. Karen Nyberg spent 180 days aboard the International Space Station, and now she has spent 45 minutes aboard the Lovecraft Show.
Surely when she was on the International Space Station, she must have had a bit of time on her hands to do some craft.
I believe she did.
Let's find out all about it. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Marion.
You will never guess who we're talking to today.
I haven't got it.
She's out of this world.
Really?
She is. Yeah, she's supersonic. She's out of this world.
Astronomical.
But actually, she is. She's fabulous. I'd love to introduce you to Dr. Karen Nyberg, who is the 50th woman astronaut in space. Oh, we're not talking to you in space, though, Karen. Welcome to the Lovecraft Show.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Jamie and I have been so excited about talking to you all day that we've been watching your every interview you've ever done and your TED Talk, your fabulous TED Talk. And for anybody that doesn't know anything about Karen, which case, well, I can't believe that you don't know anything about Karen. But Karen, for the purposes of our podcast, is the most incredible quilter and sewer. And so we're going to talk to her today about the world of space, the space of worlds, and all her creativity and fantastic craft that goes along with it.
I've got a question I'd like to open with, if you bear with me. As a little girl in Minnesota, as you gazed up to the heavens and you looked at the magnificence of all that was out there, do you remember the moment when you thought, I'm going to be a quilter?
Actually, you know what, in all honesty, probably more so than the moment I decided I wanted to be an astronaut, because I've been doing sewing a lot longer.
Yeah, your mom taught you, right?
Yes, my mom taught me when I was really young. She used to sew a lot for us. I have five brothers and sisters, so with six kids, she would sew our snowmobile suits and our prom dresses, and I mean,
wow,
that range of everything. And so, you know, I wanted to learn from the time I was really little.
When you were eight, you made your first shirt with a collar. When you were eight years old, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, it had interfacing and everything. And,
oh,
and the
my
collar.
Goodness. Oh, that's
it was
fantastic.
Kind of a maroon flannel plaid shirt. I still have it. So when I look at it, I was like, wow, I made this.
That's
it took
incredible.
My mom a lot of patience, I think, is really what it came down to.
there's an interesting connection because, like, and I think we're probably going to jump around in history a lot. And at some point, we will talk to you about being in orbit. But for now, we'll do time. We'll do space later. You got an engineering degree. So I'm wondering whether, you know, these early building things, it sort of informed your engineering persuasions, and then that subsequently come back full circle because you make quilts and stuff like that, which is still engineering.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of an interesting path. And everybody in my family is actually really creative. My dad builds metal sculptures. My mom knits and sews, and she used to make flower arrangements and do. And so I was doing art and sewing and crafting all the time. I mean, that's just how I spent my time, making homemade paper dolls. I mean, everything. And then at some point in there, when I was also about 8 or 9 years old, is when I decided I want to be an astronaut. And I think the engineering thing came very logically then in high school when I started researching what astronauts do. But at the same time, engineering is very creative. And so I think it just kind of fit in that regard.
It's so funny. I wouldn't, because I don't know about engineering, clearly, I would never think of engineering and creativity together. But I guess that's exactly it. You have to be a creative thinker to find the sort of the problem solving, to find new ways to create things. And
yes, absolutely. It absolutely goes together. And like you said, it's full circle, because quilting is very mathematical and very logical. And then there's the creative artistic side of it. So it all does kind of go together, I think.
It's just fascinating. So there you are, 8-year-old Karen. So you've made your shirt and you've decided to be an astronaut. That, for a little girl in 19, I don't know when, but
1978,
that's a lofty ambition in 1978, isn't it?
And we all go through the phase of wanting to be space people, but you managed to pull it off, which is fascinating.
You did it. And I mean, you said, I heard you say on one of these interviews that at that moment, you must have sort of seen, or you might have seen, the first woman going into space, and that might have informed that sort of thinking, oh, I want to be an astronaut.
Yeah, absolutely. So NASA selected the first female astronauts in the, I think, January of 1978. And I would have just turned 8 years old. And they were just building the space shuttle at that time. So I'm sure it was in the news all the time. And so, you know, if that's not what I saw, it's very coincidental, I think. If that's not what informed it, I think it's a pretty big coincidence. So I think that it probably did.
And Karen, what happened sort of, if you say, for example, if you'd gone into school, maybe when you'd had this thought, because obviously with your creative parents, they probably said, yeah, great, be an astronaut. Yes. If you went into school and you said to your teacher, do you know what, I'd really like to be an astronaut. What were they like? Were they encouraging? Were they dismissive? Did you ever have any kind of pushback?
I don't remember ever having pushback, but I mean, I was telling people in school all the time. My friends all knew, they used to call me the rocket scientist. I mean, everybody knew that's what I wanted to do. So, I mean, I know my oldest sister has admitted since that she thought it was very cute when I said I wanted to be an astronaut, you know?
The like first thousand times.
Exactly. And then I, like you said, I just ended up doing it. But I never had pushback from anybody. I don't know that there was also that strong encouragement, like, oh, yeah, go do it. But it was definitely nobody tried holding me back at all.
Which is amazing. I remember when I was at school, you know, and I'm a similar vintage to you. And, you know, and if I'd have said I want to be an astronaut, they probably would have said, I mean, obviously, I probably wasn't very good at science. But that might have been part of it. But they probably just would say, would you like to be a nurse or a secretary or work in PR? I think that's probably all they ever said to me. But so I love the fact that as a little girl, you know, you had that support, that educational support from them all the way along.
And then you must dedicate kind of everything to that goal, right? I don't imagine it's something you can be a bit like, yeah, but I might still be a fishmonger. But I think I'm still doing it. Like, presumably this is 100% focus for a very long period of time.
It really was. It's interesting now when I talk to, you know, teenagers and younger folks and what do you want to be? It's very strange to me to see people that don't have a very discrete, focused goal, because I always did. And I always knew exactly what I wanted to do. So I was a little odd probably in that regard. And I have to remember now with my son, it's okay if he doesn't know, you know, it's okay if it changes, it's okay, because I was so focused.
But I mean, it sounds like he's very keen. I mean, on his dinosaurs, he might be a paleontologist there. He might be heading in that direction, do you think?
I think so. He definitely has had that interest for a very long time. I think also though, he also, as I see him more and more in school and doing projects, he's also very creative. He was just working on a presentation in a group, and he does the graphics and he does all of the, you know, he was looking at the PowerPoint presentation that one of his group mates had done. And he's like, I need to talk to him about, you know, the branding of this because it's, you know, the color should be the same and it's supposed to look, you know, and so he also has that. And so he might very well go into something paleontology oriented, but I am beginning to, as he's developing more, I'm like, will it be more scientific or will it be more on the artistic creative side? I'm not sure. And it's going to be fun to see what he ends up doing.
I think it's the most curious thing, because I remember, like, he's got two astronauts for parents. I can't imagine that happens too often. And then it's funny that he's more interested in what's completely underneath the ground. Like, you guys are like, and he's going, no.
Dig down to the old. I absolutely loved the piece you did with the dinosaurs looking back through the window to look at the Earth, you know, the Earth in the background. Let's talk about you in space and the International Space Station, because it's so exciting. And I know we can come back to the quilts, but so the first time you went up there, it was for just a short time, and then you went the second time. Tell us about that, because how did it feel?
Oh, there's probably so many paths I could go down on this. Yeah, my first trip was in 2008. It was only 2 weeks on Space Shuttle Discovery. We took up the Japanese laboratory. We were building the space station. And, you know, I mean, even the time of first being assigned to the mission, it's just so exciting. And I get assigned with a crew and we're working together and there's this huge goal that we have. And then launch day comes and it's, you know, everybody asks, were you nervous? And it's like, no, not nervous, more anxious and excited. And then that it all is very, we get trained so well that launch day is all very, you know, systematic and routine, and you get suited up and you walk to the launch pad, but it's a little different. It's quiet and it's, the launch pad is quiet. There's, you know, hardly anybody there and the vehicle's alive. The ride to orbit was incredible. That's the part where the simulation really is different than the real thing. I mean, once those solid rocket boosters lit, it's just incredible and exhilarating. And then you get to space and all of a sudden, you know, you're weightless. And the thing is, I had a job I had to do immediately when we got to space. And so I didn't get to appreciate it right away. But, you know, I had to quickly learn how to take off my helmet and my gloves and stuff it into a bag and all of that. And then get up and take pictures out of the window of the external tank as it fell. And so it wasn't until a few minutes later when that was out of view that I really turned around and looked into the cockpit at my crewmates and just the experience and just soaked it all in. And I'm like, you know, oh my gosh, I did it. I'm here. This is what I've wanted to do my whole life. And I'm here. And it was a very, I don't know. I don't even know if I describe it well, but it was quite a moment. Pretty exciting.
Profound.
I've got, you know, you sort of have these things in your head where you have to go from sort of like one section of the space station to another, with all the sort of doors and tunnels, and you have to sort of like fly through things. And is it like what we see in the movies? You know, are you really floating between, you know, through these little tunnels? And
yeah, yes, absolutely. There are a couple space movies. I mean, a lot of the space movies you watch, of course, are very science fiction. And I think the realistic ones, if you've seen Apollo 13, that was very well done, very realistic. Of course, that wasn't at a space station. That was just in this, you know, the lunar module as they were headed to the moon. So it was a very small space, but they did have separate modules that they floated between. And then the other one actually that did that part of it pretty well was Gravity. Now, yeah. As a whole, the physics and everything of Gravity was not that great. It was very, very movie-like. But the visuals of Earth and the visuals inside the space station looked very much, they did a really good job of emulating the space station and the Soyuz capsule and that sort of thing. And just, yeah, the way that they moved through the modules was pretty realistic.
How many times a day would you go, oh my God, I'm on the space station. Like, oh my goodness, I'm in space. Because you must like about 200 for the first few days. Surely it must take quite a while to settle into that.
You know, I don't remember actually saying that to myself. The time, though, that I really realized that I was very comfortable in it. So on my second mission, I rode on a Soyuz rather than a shuttle, and I was on space station for 5.5 months. So totally different experience than the first. And there was one point at a certain length of time through the mission, I don't know if it was halfway through or 2/3 of the way through, I was working out on our exercise device, which is below the cupola or above, whichever way you look at it. And between sets of deadlifts or whatever, I would float to the window and maybe look out or take a picture or something, and then go back and continue working out. I remember one time I was between sets, and I go up and I look, and we had been on this orbital path that was taking us down, I mean, over the Pacific Ocean, which would go last forever. And then we'd go down over around this tip of South America. And so we're over ocean all the time. And I looked out and I'm like, oh, South America again. And it was like this. And I stopped myself and I realized I am starting to take this for granted, you know, and, wow. You know, I was disappointed in what I was seeing because I just saw that last time I looked out the window and I kind of, from that point on, had to really almost remind myself and what it really made me conscious of. And I try to remember that, and it's hard in my daily life, but try to remember what happens to all of us on a day-to-day basis that is pretty remarkable, but it just seems, oh, that again, you know, because we see it all the time or we do it all the time. But, you know, maybe if we step back and just think about it a little more, that it's a lot more remarkable than what we think our mundane every life is.
Without wishing to get too esoteric, because I can do, but I think that's the purpose of life, no? To understand how magnificent our life is and what a miracle it is.
Yeah.
And we do take it for granted. And I spend a lot of my time, because I've got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and I keep trying to do that just to go, hey, this stuff's pretty cool. You know, you're pretty cool. There's that story about the man who's hanging from a vine off a sort of cliff, and beneath him a tiger is circling, and he knows if he falls he's going to get eaten, and he notices that a mouse is starting to chew through the vine, and he sees a strawberry, and he reaches and eats the strawberry, and it's the tastiest strawberry he's ever eaten in his entire life because he knows it's the last strawberry. And it's almost like, I think we're supposed to appreciate life like that if we can, because right. Life's that good, but we just take it in our stride all the time.
Yep, absolutely.
Why did he not give the mouse the strawberry?
I thought that's where the strawberry was.
I thought the same thing.
He's going to distract the mouse with the strawberry. Yes,
throwing the mouse to the tiger.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Thanks, yeah. Marianne. You've ruined it.
He never said the guy was very bright.
Yeah, right, yeah. What's he doing hanging off a vine? Let's not. I don't know his backstory. It was just a beautiful story until we ruined it.
No, it doesn't ruin. What I couldn't believe when you were talking about the space station was it's been up there for 20 years. And so, of course, I thought, so this is why everybody has to keep going up and coming back. There must be so much maintenance all the time. And this is not just giving the bathroom a fresh coat of paint. I mean, this is really doing big stuff, isn't it? You've got to update all the technology all the time.
Yeah, the space station, the first crew launched in November of 2020, or 2000, I mean, so 22 years ago.
Wow.
And it's been continually inhabited since then. And I think they were planning on using it until at least 2015. And then we've just been extending it and extending it and extending it. And so there are things that break. I mean, we do a lot of preventive maintenance when we're there. We do a lot of actual maintenance when we're there. They just recently changed out some of the batteries. You know, after 20 years, any battery, there's better technology, and that's external batteries. So they had to do spacewalks to do it. It's batteries that are charged from the solar arrays to use when we are not in the sun, you know, and as technology gets better and as those start to wear out, they've replaced a bunch of those, and they put up a new set of a smaller set of solar arrays, some more efficient use of getting solar energy. But yeah, I mean, it's been up there a really long time. And, you know, I think another thing that happens is you have new crews constantly, and the teams on the ground really have to keep it in order, because the stowage of where things are kept, somebody has to keep track of that. And there are teams on the ground that, you know, can tell you where every single little washer is, or screwdriver, or, you know, any piece of equipment, because it could get lost so easily with all these, you know, people coming back and forth and everybody using it. So
then when you said, I'd like to take a small needle point kit onto the space station, These small, tiny, sharp objects that could get sucked into vents and all those sorts of things. How was that idea received?
Well, I took up a, well, and there actually is a sewing kit on board, but it's more of an industrial sewing kit. And one of my crewmates actually used it to fix his leather weightlifting glove. And I took a picture of him. I saw him sitting there one day sewing, and I was like, this is great, you're sewing. And I was so excited that he was doing that. And so it's kind of more of a heavy duty, you know, like I said, industrial sewing kit. So there are little things. I brought a magnetic case. And then also inside the magnetic case, it has one of those plastic, you know, when you buy needles, often there's a plastic, stuck in a plastic thing. And so I kept them in there. So they're secure in there and then on the magnet in the magnetic case. So, and the beauty though, like if I'm, you know, I thread a needle and I'm sewing and it would, if I dropped it, I immediately look, it's still right there. Now, if I dropped it and didn't know I dropped it, that's when it's impossible to find things in space, because it usually what happens is you turn your head to the right, you turn your head to the left, and you can't find it. Somebody comes up and it's right behind your head and you just didn't see it either way you were looking.
Can you tell us the tale of the dinosaur? Because this is what first tuned me into you. I pretty much heard about that around the time that you made it, and it always stuck in my mind. And then when we were talking about guests for the show and stuff, I was like, here's an idea. I know about this dinosaur that was made in space. Can you tell us about it?
So my son Jack was 3 when I went on this trip. And of course, I didn't like leaving him for 6 months. And so I tried to get him included in my mission as much as possible. I made a short video on my iPad every single day that I emailed to my husband just to tell my son, to tell him I love him. Because you can't, a 3-year-old, I wasn't going to be able to talk to on the phone, or he just wasn't interested in that. So I made these little videos for him. And then since I had the sewing supplies there, I wanted to make something for him when I was there. And there's this fabric that lines the Russian food containers. The Russian food containers are these metal boxes. And there's this really kind of ugly green fabric that lines the bottom of them. And all of our stuff has Velcro on it. So the cans of food, the Russians, most of their food or a lot of their food is in cans. And there's a piece of Velcro on it. And then it sticks in these food containers. And this fabric is kind of that pile Velcro, like a little bit stiffer than pile Velcro, actually. And so Jack already was interested in dinosaurs at the age of 3. So I came up with this idea, I'm going to make him a dinosaur. And I asked my commander, Fyodor, if I could have some of that fabric from the food containers. And so he started bringing a bunch to me. And there's different shades of green, all of it very muted shades of green. But so he brought me some of those. And the day that I ended up sewing it was a Sunday, and we were supposed to be capturing a cargo vehicle that day. And the cargo vehicle had launched and was in orbit, but there was something wrong. They weren't going to rendezvous with the space station that day, but they didn't tell us I had no work to do all day because I had exercised first thing in the morning. I got everything done because the rest of the day was going to be working on capturing this cargo vehicle and getting it installed and everything. But they waved off the cargo vehicle coming on board. And so I had the rest of the day with literally nothing to do, which didn't happen very often. I had done my exercise, nothing else going on. And so I got out a piece of paper and I sketched just a very simple, I'm like, I have to make this simple or I'm not going to be able to get it done. So I sketched this very simple dinosaur and just spent the day planning it and cutting it out and sewing it. And then I stuffed it with, I have a couple old t-shirts that I was done wearing, and we don't do laundry there. We just put it in a cargo vehicle that then disintegrates in Earth's atmosphere and burns up all of our trash. So I just cut up to stuff it with some t-shirt. So I cut up a couple old t-shirts and stuffed it with it. And that, how the dinosaur was born.
Such a absolutely good story. Amazing. It is amazing. And then the quilt square. So you decided then to make that block, that amazing quilt block.
Everybody should see the tutorial kind of video on YouTube. If you ever want to, you know, if you ever like, oh, I might go to space, might make a thing. This is a great introduction. It's isn't it?
So it's this beautiful, so you took 3 fat quarters with you up to space, and then you made this beautiful, designed a great sort of quilt block with a starburst. And then how many other people did you go out onto social media and say to people, right, okay, let's see how many blocks we can get sewn? And so many came back to NASA.
Yeah, we ended up getting over 2,400, I think, from 30 different countries.
Wow.
You know, most were from the United States. There were several from Canada, from Russia, from the UK. I mean, but there was, you know, some countries with one or two. Yeah, it was really quite a project. It turned bigger than I had ever hoped, actually.
What I thought was wonderful as well, when those blocks were all put together to make the quilts, that you were saying that when you'd been to see them, you read some of the letters that had come with the quilt blocks. And I mean, just beautiful stories of some people who loved space that had never quilted before. I mean, that must have been amazing to have inspired so many people to join you in making a quilting block.
It really was. And I a couple of years ago is when we went to the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas at Austin, where they're being stored in their quilt collection. And they took all of them out for us. There are like 28 full or king size quilts. And I had seen them before hanging at the International Quilt Festival in Houston, but I didn't take the time to really go and look at, you know, you kind of just see them from a distance and you see these beautiful quilts. But then they were laid out on tables and I could go and look at, you know, just look at each block. And it's so interesting to look at each block and think about the thought. I mean, just knowing when I make my own quilts or designs or, you know, the thought you put into what colors you choose and the fabrics you choose and why you did the design the way you did. And so each one of these, and you think about then the individual person that did that. And then yes, I went and looked through they kept all of the letters that were submitted and all the notes with these blocks. And it was really neat to kind of put a connection then. And I still want to go, I took pictures of all the letters and the notes so that I actually have them on my computer. And what would be really fun someday is make sure that I understand which block is with which letter and even talk to some of these people and find out who they are and what they were thinking when they did it and why they did it. And
that sounds like a very nice book to me.
Of similar projects. I did one with the National Trust here in the UK where we got people to make cross-stitch baubles. In fact, weirdly, I've got some here. This is a weird coincidence, but like we invited people to make cross-stitch baubles and we got over 900 of them. And again, from different parts of the world. And I remember it's almost like you can't get too deep into it because otherwise you're just like, it's absolutely beautiful. With like all these different stories of people, like people from Malta, people from this place and stuff. And you know how much time and love they've given to it. And I remember like doing the opening and just being like, this is really nice. Not really being able to talk properly about it. Like, I love it. One of the things I love about these kind of projects is if you give people a reason to make something for good, if you give them a good reason, people respond to it so well. And those quilts of yours were like dazzling. They're so beautiful and they're so like packed with joy and energy. And that's like the surface layer, isn't it? And then, like you say, you get into the stories and you get into all those sorts of things. It must be incredibly like, I don't know, like humbling.
It really is. And they are so much, even so much more beautiful when you look at them closely and see the individuals. But it's also, you know, I mean, the reason that I wanted to do a project like this, and like I said, it turned out even more than I expected, was just bringing the world together. And the quilt really does that. When you look at Earth from space, it's almost like the quilt from a distance. And it's just this, it's beautiful. And then you look at each individual spot and you look at all the different people that live in different spots and the different ecosystems on Earth and all that. It's like looking at it close up then and appreciating the individual beauty and how it all comes together to one big, beautiful piece.
It's wonderful because it's everybody stitching the fabric of life, isn't it? It's everything brought together with so much emotion. That wanting to be part of something. And it reminds me so much of the story that you told about your colleague when you were on the International Space Station and he had water in his suit and he was drowning. And then the team, that all of you got together and you brought him back in and you saved his life and he was okay. And you were so conscious that it was a team effect. It was, you know, it's the team all together. And this whole sort of concept about the fact of you looking down at the Earth and that the Earth is a spaceship and then we're all the same crew. And I thought that was so beautiful. And it's like this sort of coming together to create something fantastic, like with the quilt, you know, and the fact that we can, if we all pull together, we can do something about the Earth in great peril, and I'm jumping straight into climate change here, but that is something that's very close to your heart, I know, and a lot of your work, your artwork, is about, you know, the climate and the Earth and how we can help.
Yes, absolutely. And the work that NASA and our international partners have done on the International Space Station is probably the best example of international collaboration and working together and having a common goal and getting along despite differences and all of that. It's probably the best example ever. And we're still doing it, even after all that's going in the world, you know, today. We just had an American astronaut fly to space on a Russian Soyuz, because we collaborate and we work together, and that's what we're doing. In fact, he just launched yesterday. And so it's such a perfect example. And if we could all just get on board together and treat each other as though we are crewmates, even on a space station, you would never, ever, ever let one of your crewmates down. You would never do anything, let anything happen to them and for them to get harmed. And so why do we do that on Earth? Why do we not pull for one another and try to compromise and learn communication skills with one another? And and expeditionary behavior is what we call it in space, is that great expeditionary behavior of watching out for one another and communicating properly and making sure you understand each other, and also watching out for yourself. You know, all of those things that we learn in order to make the space business work and have successful missions in space.
And it seems like every, I can't say every, but for a great majority of astronauts come back from space with an entirely changed perspective on the planet. Can you explain like your thesis now? Can you tell us your perspective? Because it's unlikely we'll get to see it.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's, I think I don't know an astronaut who has not come back thinking that their perspective has changed one way or another. And to me, I think there's a couple different aspects to it. One aspect is seeing Earth at that distance. And, you know, we're only 250 miles off the surface of the Earth. And so we're not that far away, but it's very clear that Earth is there in the blackness of space, and it's all by itself, and it's the atmosphere is so thin, and it's all connected, and the ecosystems are all connected, and it's so beautiful that you come back wanting to protect it. And something as simple as the trash we produce, there's so much now that we buy, and a lot of it is very cheap. Not just inexpensive, but cheaply made, so that it is trash very soon. We don't have it very, very long. And we'll say, well, we'll just throw it away. Well, it's no longer in our house. We've gotten rid of it, but it never goes away. And it's still on our spaceship, and it's always going to be here. Some of the plastics and some of these things are always going to be here. And so if we start thinking of Earth as our home, you know, and that's just one example, but to think of it as our home where we don't want to trash it. Actually, I had a friend that his analogy was, if aliens came to Earth and started pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and throwing trash in the oceans, nothing, I think at that point is when all humans would come together and say, stop trashing our home, you know, because there's somebody who's messing it up. But right now we're messing it up, and we need to get that. We need to kind of come together that way and say, why are we messing it up? We wouldn't let somebody else do it, I don't think. And then the other aspect of seeing the Earth from space is thinking about the people on Earth and realizing that somebody on the opposite side of the Earth, place I've never been, is not that different from me. You know, we're all breathing the same air. We're all, in essence, eating the same food, surviving the same way, drinking the same water. We all need the same things to survive. We're all human beings. And everybody is our neighbor on Earth. And so we should be treating each other that way.
Do you think there are ways that, in the absence of us having our own personal international space stations, are there ways that we can get that perspective? Like, one of the thoughts was, you know, you guys see it, and you guys see that we're a small planet and we're tiny people on a small planet, and we should be precious to one another. What do you think we can do to gain that perspective?
That's a really good question. And I don't know if I know the answer to that. And I think there are people that do. I mean, I think there are people who have come to that conclusion on their own. And I don't know how to get everyone there. You know, it's too bad we can't just let people go up and do a few orbits of the Earth. But yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Because, I mean, there's a good analogy with the space station, like you said, and the duty and the care that you have to provide for the environment you're in, because otherwise you're going to sort of die. And it's like the caring of the machine is a craft in and of itself. It's kind of weird because we talk about crafts and everybody thinks about the traditional crafts we're familiar with. But any act of care and attention is in itself a craft. And so perhaps that's the thing, is saying, you know, and I can remember being like, oh, I'm going to change the world and all those sorts of things. And now I'll be grateful if I change the world of cross stitch, because I've realized like what's within my realm and stuff. And maybe that's the thing. Maybe what we have to do is just to learn to be careful of the to craft our environment, because we can reach that and we can touch that. And you've had the perspective of seeing the whole of it. Whereas for the rest of us, maybe we should just, there's something about lamps, isn't there? Like we can shine a light and we can affect the thing that is within the light that we can see. And maybe if we just focus on that and not worry about the stuff that we can't see, if everybody's focusing on what they can see, then we should have it all covered. Does that make any sense?
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
It would be very
nice. We can try.
Do most astronauts marry other astronauts? Is that the kind of one of the few ways you can kind of get around it? Because it's like
not most, but it has happened. And what's interesting is so of course I married Doug, who was one of my classmates in the class of 2000 of astronauts, and then two of our best friends also got married from the same class. And then Doug flew with Bob on that the SpaceX first crewed flight, that test flight. So they flew together, best friends since we were selected. And then, of course, Megan and I friends. So the whole group. So there are several married couples through the years, but it's not super common. But
because the portrait of him, which people should go and find, because it's sublime. Like there are a couple of artists I'll show you later. There's one called Ian Berry who does portraiture that kind of reminds me of you, but all out of denim.
I've seen that. He does amazing work. I love that too.
Yeah, he is. He's amazing.
I saw the portrait of Doug and it kind of reminded me of that. Like it's a beautiful picture, and I know that you made it while he was up in space as well, so it's kind of almost like a love letter and also a sort of therapeutic tool as well, I would guess.
Yeah, I think so. And I want to start doing images, you know, portraits of people more, because that's what I used to like to draw all the time. And I don't know if anything you have read or seen videos of me telling about making that and how I ended up making it the way I did it. So I was in my studio working on it, and I was trying to pick out fabrics to use for his skin. And I was so frustrated because I could not get the color combinations right. And our son, Jack, came in the room. So he was 10 at the time. And he's like, "What's wrong, Mom?" And I'm like, "I just can't get the right colors, fabrics to make his skin." And because I showed him what I was making and everything, he's like, "Well, Mom, why don't you just make Daddy black and white and then make the patch on his shoulder colored?" And I was like, "That's genius." And so I went through my stash and I picked out every gray, white, black fabric I had. And I just started, you know, laying out the values. And I don't even think I had to shop for any. I had enough in my collection. But the funny thing is it kind of goes back to I used to always draw in black and white, and I always struggled a little bit with color. Even when I took the painting classes, I just never got really good at it. So I think it was kind of perfect for me to go back into the black and white. But I loved his suggestion, and I think it turned out great like that.
Oh, so it really did. I mean, it's we will put links to your website and all of your work in the show notes. So don't worry if you're listening, you'll be able to find Karen's fantastic portraits in the show notes. Also, I mean, some of it, I know you say you don't necessarily sort of feel that comfortable with color, but some of the color in, you know, the way that you've recreated the sea and the skies and the other work is just amazing.
Well, I guess I'll say with color, I like playing with color when it doesn't have to look realistic. It's
yeah.
When you're working on a person, especially somebody you know, to me it was very frightening to try to get that likeness. Well, even, you know, and I had to kind of let that go a little bit. I did a portrait of our two dogs. This was a gift for my husband. I don't know if you saw that one, a chocolate lab and a yellow lab. And the yellow lab, I literally used yellow fabrics, and the color of the yellow lab is not really yellow, you know, but it's hard to find the color fabrics that that look exactly like the dog. And so I tried for a while and I had to let that go and say, I'm interpreting the dog and this is how I'll make him look.
I think one of the things about quilting that I find fascinating actually is that when you look at an array of quilting fabrics, there are so many different patterns. Patterns that if they were standalone, you might really dislike. And then you start putting them next to each other in however many ways they're going to go next to each other, and it all works. And it's so clever. So when you curate a collection of fabrics, you've got this sort of all these different textures and prints. How do you, when you did your Robert Kaufman collections, how did you choose all those fabrics that worked together?
It took a little while, and I guess, the goal was to get exactly that, the range of textures, and that came from the various pictures that we used, the pictures I'd taken from space. And I, wanted to get some that were a little bigger, smaller texture and that sort of thing. And then the color ranges, kind of the same thing. But then also, to me, it was also important to get the value range. And so I did a lot of taking pictures and turning it to black and white to see if I do that a lot. That's one of my tricks because you look at it, it's like, especially two different colors, it's hard to tell. If you put them next to each other on a art piece, it's not going to show any depth at all. And so I do that a lot. I'll lay out things and take a picture, turn it to black and white and look at it. And I'm like, oh, this one belongs over here. This one's way darker than it looks when I'm looking at it. And so that same process, I kind of went through in selecting which range of colors and values to go with.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's such a lovely overlay as well, because you do... So many people make art about landscapes and nature and stuff like that, and you've been afforded this like unique perspective. So I think that's one of the things that's amazing about the art pieces you make. And then I guess with the fabrics as well, isn't it? They're very much of this perspective that few of us get, and it gives you the opportunity to give... It's almost like we can then play with the beauty of the world from your perspective a little bit, because you've given us that view. And I don't think... It doesn't feel like many of us would be able to do that. And when you make your pieces as well, like there's a piece of the Brazilian coastline, isn't it? And you've said that while we're looking down at it and the water, like the blue color is the sea, in many ways you're exploring the fact that that could also be the sky, and you're kind of just playing with those kind of perspectives as well.
Absolutely. When I loved taking pictures from the space station when I was there of Earth, and I would frame them on purpose like that a lot when I would take the pictures to try to make it look artistic in some way. I'd look down and what I would see a mountain, which was really a coastline and the ocean. And so I would take the picture that way because that's in my mind what I was seeing. Or if there was a cloud pattern, I'd like to frame it so that it looked the most artistic, in that the frame of the photo. And then even the horizon photos I took, generally it was something about it that I thought looked so artistic, is the reason I took that picture and framed it the way I did.
Like, now that you've started doing these pieces, do you feel that there's a creative direction you're going with your art? Are you heading in? Because the other thing you were saying about like the different fabrics and stuff is, I guess you can use thread painting as a way of mitigating color transitions and stuff, can't you? You can very much play with that. And I guess that then gives you the opportunity to explore texture and various gradations, which are the sort of things you'd be seeing when you're looking down on the Earth.
Yeah, I love that. I love that the thread painting, like you said, I can make those transitions and make it look smooth and kind of blend the fabrics together. And yeah, it's fun to pick a fabric, especially I like, fabrics with flowers in it and that sort of thing. Like the one of the coast of Morocco, I picked a batik fabric that had white flowers on a blue, and then those are kind of depicting the clouds. So that was fun to kind of work with and piece those together to kind of match the picture.
Do you think you'll be doing more geographic pieces? You feel like you've got something?
I would like to. One of my problems is I have so many favorite photos that I took from space that picking which favorite photos are the ones I try to use is difficult. But yeah, I'm hoping to do some more of those.
Karen, you are the most incredible inspiration. People just must be I'm so inspired. I want to get my machine out now. I want to go to space. Obviously, it is me to be overexcited, but I mean, people must just, if you go and speak somewhere, people must just be so excited to listen to you talk.
It's funny you say that, because it's all, I mean, I look at me as me, and it's like, why would somebody be that interested in listening to me talk? And that's just because I'm just a small town girl from Minnesota and who was lucky and happened to do some amazing things. But I also feel it's actually part of my duty, having been paid by the U.S. government for so many years and experiencing things that on behalf of everybody else in the world, that it's my job to share that as well. And speak about it. And it is interesting. And I think sometimes, you know, especially when little kids get so excited about the things that I was able to do and the things that they potentially could do.
Absolutely.
That part of it, when kids get excited and think, well, maybe this is something I could do too. And even if they strive to be an astronaut and turn out to be a NASA engineer or a scientist in any field, or, you know, even if that aspiration of being an astronaut turns them into some, you know, gives them some other amazing career where they contribute to society in a very positive way, I think is great.
You summed it up really well. I think it was a talk you did with NASA not long after you'd landed. There were quite a lot of young children in the audience. And I think one girl said, you know, how can I become an astronaut? And you just said, just do your best. Just be the best that you can be. And I think that's really beautiful, because I think sometimes you said it as well about like dreaming and seeing yourself as an astronaut. But I think that if we don't set ourselves up for fall, if you just say like, do your best and don't worry about what that sort of is, then I think that that's a sort of path to success regardless.
It really is. And I mean, to be honest, to become an astronaut requires a lot of luck as well. I mean, you kind of have to be, you know, right now we're only selecting classes every 4 years, and there are certain medical issues that prevent you from doing it. And we only select classes of like between 8 and 15 people, 17 people. So the chances of becoming are very slim. And so it does take luck as well. But what I like to tell people is it does take that luck, but what you need to do is set yourself up to accept that luck. Mm. You know, if you don't work hard and do your best and study the things that will get you there, when that lucky chance comes along, you're not going to be prepared for it, and you're not going to be able to accept that luck. So do your best.
Like that. There's also, I think there's another saying that like inspiration strikes, but it likes to find you working, which I guess is analogous to that as well, isn't it? That's amazing. Yep. I think, yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you. I can't believe that we've managed to have a crafting podcast and talk to an astronaut. It's absolutely fantastic.
It is unbelievable. It's just thrilling.
If people want to find out more about you, other than you're an astronaut, it's quite easy. Where can people, like, you know, connect with your work? Where can people find out what you're up to?
I have a website, KarenNyberg.com, and also linked through there is a store, KarenNybergArt.com, which I sell prints of some of the things that I have made, and also sell patterns for the quilts that I designed to use the Earthviews fabric from Robert Kaufman. And also I have social media, and I'm not as good at social media as I probably should be. I don't post as much as some people, but I have an Instagram and a Facebook and a Twitter that I even use a little less than the other two, but Instagram's probably what I use the most now. And it's at AstroKarenN, if I remember correctly.
So, well, we'll put all the links into the show notes. Karen, I'm just thrilled to bits, speechless. I'm absolutely thrilled that you came to talk to us. We've had a fantastic, this hour has gone so fast. Mm. I've just been so inspirational.
It's really, really fun to talk to you guys. And like you had said, the world's colliding of space and art and crafting, I think is fantastic. I'd like to see that more.
I'm sure there's so much scope. I can't wait. It's very exciting.
What book are we reviewing this week, Marion?
We are reviewing a very beautiful book, actually, this week. This is called Crochet with Flowers and Plants. 35
right.
Beautiful patterns inspired by nature and the seasons by the mighty Kate Eastwood.
What's interesting about this, knowing nothing about crochet, other than what I've learned from you over the dozens and dozens of years, there's something pretty remarkable about this book in the way that she has been able to create real life in crochet.
Yeah, she's an incredible crocheter, Kate Eastwood. Now, I've known Kate a long time and we have worked a lot with her at Lovecraft. So I feel that I'm in a uniquely positioned place to be able to honestly tell you, listeners, about these patterns and about the work in this book. I've firstly got to make a point of saying that with a Kate Eastwood pattern, you know that it's tested and tried and it's going to work. And I think that's really important with crochet because, well, any sort of knitting or crochet pattern, because some people just don't sort of check their patterns or write, but these ones are supersonically checked and Kate Eastwood patterns are always really good. So in this book, there are, I'll tell you exactly how many, because I'm flipping, you can hear me flipping, 35 patterns. And these patterns are set up into sections. So there's a section for blankets and cushions, decorations, table decorations, hanging decorations, and Christmas. So it takes you all the way through the year. Now, what I love about Kate's things, especially like the blankets and the cushions, is that the actual construction of the blankets or the cushions is always going to be really straightforward. So it's going to be sort of like simple stitches. You make the cushion or you whatever, and then you embellish it with things. And that's Kate's style.
Right. Using the Mr. X Stitch Guide to Cross Stitch is the only book that can ever have a 10 scale of book rating. What are you going to give it?
Do you know what? I'm going to give this a 9.8.
Ooh.
Yes, I'm going to give it a 9.8 because the patterns are very comprehensive. It is packed with patterns. There are so many things in this book that you can use for other things. So whether you want to make all of Kate's beautiful projects or you just want to take, oh, I know, I want to make a few leaves to put on this, or I want to make some flowers to applique onto a jumper, you can go into this book and find something. Yeah. To put somewhere else. So that's what I'm going to give it, a big fat 9.8. Crochet with Flowers and Plants by Kate Eastwood.